Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Earlier this week, the Allman Brothers Band released a simple statement announcing that their postponed concerts from March here in New York had finally been rescheduled for October. Oh, and that this would be the end of the Allman Brothers Band after 45 years. I kind of like that they did it in such a low-key way. Now, two of the group's frontmen, singer-guitarist Warren Haynes and slide guitarist Derek Trucks, had already announced this was going to be their last season with the band because they both lead other groups. So this isn't a complete shock, but still, 45 years, it is the end of an era. For Warren Haynes, it means time to spend with his own band, Government Mule, which is a mere 20 years old. Today, Warren will join us solo to sing and play live. And guitar fans, you'll want to stay tuned after that, because we'll also talk with the filmmaker behind a new documentary about the great bluesman B.B. King. But first, there's a new Mike Myers movie. No, it's not another Austin Powers comedy or a new addition to the popular Shrek series. It's a documentary, and a rather unusual one. Here, let me play you a clip from the trailer in which you'll hear both Mike Myers and the subject of the film.
Chef Gordon is the nicest person I've ever met, hands down.
The three most important things a manager does: get the money, to always remember to get the money, never forget to always remember to get the money.
In the music world, it's not that often that we hear about managers, you know, those behind-the-scenes gurus who work with musicians and actors and other entertainers. But a new documentary tells the story of a truly unusual manager, and a very powerful one. Why is he unusual? Well, maybe the title of the film will give you a clue. It's called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, and it brings Shep Gordon to our studio. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Nice to be here today.
So, this film is full of, among other things, still photos of you, usually to the left of some immediately recognizable famous person, a musician or an actor or what have you. How does it feel to be that person in the center for an hour and a half?
It's like watching Forrest Gump on a loop.
Or Zelig. I mean, you're like...
You're Zelig on a loop.
The Zelig-like character. It's like...
You know, it's bizarre, though. It's I think for every human, you wake up, you do what you do, you go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that's really the rhythm. And in the middle of it, things happen. And for me, it's sort of gumpish.
So you kind of fall into this career. And basically, by basically falling over Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin one night when you're, like, out of your mind in a hotel in L.A., right?
Yeah, I'm sort of – I'm one of the few people of the last 100 years of repression who can say I'm successful because I'm Jewish. Jimi Hendrix said, you're Jewish, you should be a manager. To me and my partner, I had a partner named Joe Greenberg at that time.
And so that was literally his first question to you, was, are
you
Jewish?
No, the first question was, how much is the acid?
And how far into this conversation were you before he decided that you should manage somebody and that he had someone in mind?
Well, I think, you know, as time tends to do, it changes. It becomes a revisionist story. Mm. So in the movie, it appears as if it's a matter of minutes.
Yes.
But it wasn't. It was an evolution. And it's an evolution that it's funny, I was speaking to Alice about it, and I was speaking to my old partner, Joey, about it. And
that's Alice Cooper.
Alice Cooper. And we all have different recollections of it. But the through line to it that is true is that we checked into this motel. We were selling drugs. Jimmy was sort of a client. We were sitting around with the Chambers brothers, who were always there.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, what would you do if the police asked you where you got the money for the room? In watch, that's what they do. If you're wearing a new watch, I remember him saying to me, if I had a new watch, I better be able to tell the police where I got it. And I said, you know, I'm a middle-class Jew from Long Island. I never saw a policeman. They didn't ask. He said, well, you better get a cover. You're Jewish, aren't you? And I said, yeah. You should be a manager. So I said, great. And he turned to Lester Chambers and said, are those freaks from Phoenix still living in your basement? And Alice and the band were living in the Chambers Brothers' basement.
Really?
Yes. They had opened for him at a show, and they asked, and they were staying there. So it was Lester who went to Alice.
So what was your – did you know anything about music? Did you grow up listening to music?
I love Bob Dylan, love the Rolling Stones. I would not call myself a music fanatic, but I did love music.
And what did you think the first time you saw or heard Alice Cooper?
I thought they were horrible. They were very theatrical, which wasn't part of my world.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't particularly care because it really – it wasn't like I was looking for a profession. I wanted a front.
Right, right.
And they seemed perfect because I didn't think they would really be successful. So it wouldn't take time.
So you had your own little producer's thing happening.
I had my own producer's thing happening.
Let's put on a show that's really bad.
Yeah, exactly. Look what happened.
So, but at some point, the penny drops and you realize that if you make him that bad, he'll actually be great.
Well, I think what we all realized is that entertainment is about creating a reaction. And the hardest thing to do is get a reaction. And although his was a negative reaction, there was something at the core that was getting to people.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could take that energy and turn it, that there was something really magical there. We didn't know what we had.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us knew what we had. But we knew there was something.
It's funny you use the word magical because you do get into some sleight of hand stuff, you know, the photo of a naked Alice with, you know, his crotch covered by a snake or whatever, you know, to gin up the ticket sales in London.
Yeah.
Hiring fake paparazzi, mm-hmm, just to get the light bulbs popping.
Yeah.
And then there's the plastic clothes, which is an hysterical moment in the history of Alice Cooper and of my guest, Shep Gordon. Listen.
We knew that if you could get the parents to hate you, the kids were going to love you.
I came up with this ridiculous idea of buying see-through clothes made out of clear plastic, putting Alice on stage naked, basically, and calling the police and getting him arrested for indecent exposure, which we assumed would get newspaper coverage and would get parents to say, ooh, these guys are disgusting. They played naked. They get up on stage completely naked. People in the audience are like, oh, my God. So I went to a phone booth and called the police, told them that I had my child at a club and this band was naked on stage and this was horrible. How could they allow this to happen? Put the phone down. I hear a siren. And as the police come around, their see-through clothes had fogged up from the heat and you couldn't see anything. And the police came in and looked around like, what, are they crazy, and left. After the show, I said, you know, we've just hit that classic moment where we can't get arrested. It's definitely time to leave the city. We actually went to that very historic club called The Experience. It was on Sunset Boulevard, and Jimmy used to play there. Buddy Miles used to play there. It was a great place. And the clothes were made by Neil Smith's sister, Cindy, who ended up marrying Dennis Dunaway.
So you remember, like, names, dates, places, times.
I don't know if it's true, but
you,
I have
but
a memory.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
There is a funny moment in the movie where I have this very clear, I still to this moment have a clear recollection of sitting next to Pablo Picasso. And Mike researched it, and he had died 2 years before that event occurred. And he says it in the movie, but
Mike being Mike Myers.
Mike Myers, excuse me.
Who, this movie, which is called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, is not only directed by Mike Myers, he's in it. It's his directorial debut. And one of the things he talks about in the film is how he first met you, which was he's doing Wayne's World, and he wants to use an Alice Cooper track. And so he comes to you to kind of negotiate the use of something classic from the Alice Cooper canon. This is Mike Myers talking about that initial go-round with my guest, Shep Gordon.
I met Shep Gordon in 1991 on the set of Wayne's World.
And when I went in, Mike was fairly set on using 18 or Schools Out. But I went in with a real agenda.
Shep came in and went,
how about something from the new album?
And I said, how about no? And then he went,
I happen to know that you start shooting in 2 weeks. So you really don't have a choice.
So I was able to take a very strong position. Not unreasonable, but strong.
He said, but I read the script, and the band is on stage only for 8 seconds.
You're not going to remember. And if we put schools out in the end credits, everyone's going to think that's the song he sang.
So they end up using Feed My Frankenstein.
Yes, which became the single.
For Wayne's World. So now, again, the film called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, directed by Mike Myers, Shep Gordon, artist manager, entertainment industry insider, the subject of the new movie and my guest on Soundcheck. It's called Supermensch. I could easily imagine this movie having been called Super Schmuck. Right. With all due respect, you know. I mean, someone with an agenda, someone who meets you and you, the first thing you say to them is, I know you're in a tight spot. You only have 2 weeks. You're going to take what I give you. This could easily have been, with all the women and the drugs and stuff, this could easily have been a much darker film.
Absolutely.
Somehow, these people all love you. How does this happen?
I'm not quite sure. this is Mike's movie, and it's so beautifully done. My feeling is that it's sort of a love letter to me. And it's this beautifully crafted story. And I'm sure there are people along the way who do think I'm super schmuck. But that wasn't the story he was telling.
Well, I mean, at what point did this become a part of your business ethic at some point to be a mensch, to play fair with your clients?
I think always. I'm very lucky. My first client was Alice Cooper. And Alice is the mensch of all time. So as a manager, you're really in service, and you can advise, you can make suggestions, but you're in service. It's not your life, it's not your career. So the way you deal with the world sometimes is not the way you would deal with the world, but it's the way your artist wants you to. And in most cases, most artists enjoy bloodletting. I don't mean that in a negative way, it's part of the training. It's very hard to keep getting slapped and turn the other cheek.
Uh-huh.
And if you're in the entertainment business, you are slapped daily. Bad reviews, bad accountings. It's horrible. Alice can turn his cheek every time. And I feel like I sort of can. So when we are faced with situations where normally you would go for blood, I was able to sit him down. I remember a specific moment. Sammy Hagar was opening for us in Tampa, Florida. He was in a band that was making very little money. It was actually the beginning of my relationship with Sammy. And there was a tornado, which meant there was no show.
Right.
They were getting $500 for the show from the promoter. We were getting, I think, $25,000. We could live without the $25,000. They couldn't live without the $500. Promoter didn't want to pay it. I went to Alice. I sat him down. And I said, listen, this isn't fair. It's fair for the promoter not to pay him, but it's not fair for us.
Yeah.
We really should pay him. And Al said, great, let's do it. And we gave him the $500. I don't think that's ever happened in Sammy's life before.
Yeah, probably after,
right,
either.
So I was very lucky. My first artist was someone who allowed me to live my life the way I wanted to.
Yeah. And the roster of people that you would eventually work with, I mean, from the shock rock of Alice Cooper, you end up with Anne Murray.
Yeah, basically you know? The same for what I do.
Really?
Yeah, as a manager, you know, for a manager, it's when an artist has a gift, my job is to put it in a picture frame that makes it easy for people to understand that gift, that gets right to the point. So whether it's an Anne Murray who you're saying, this is the greatest voice you have ever heard, and you figure out a picture frame that of credibility for her, or it's Alice who you say, you know, we can get your parents to hate him
right
better than anyone, or if it's Teddy Pendergrass, who's the sexiest man in the world, it's getting it in a picture frame that, so it can be fast foods but not lose the magic.
Right. So kids, you're going to like Alice Cooper because your parents will hate her. Parents, here's Anne Murray. And for those of you who are on the hunt, here's
exactly.
Teddy Pendergrass.
Or if you're hungry, here's Emeril.
Right. Now, how you are, I mean, your career evolves from music to film to celebrity chefs. You know, somebody makes the point at some point in the film that you are essentially the creator of the cult of the celebrity chef. Is that, how did that happen?
Like everything in my life sort of tripped into it. I always felt that mentors were important in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person that came into my circle of life was a chef, just by happenstance, named Roger Verger. And in order to hang out with him, I learned how to cook.
Uh-huh.
And after about 10
years... How old were you?
I was 27, 28. He was 60, maybe 50, 55.
So you were already.
I was very successful.
Yeah.
I was very. Yeah. But I also knew that I was headed for a crash. Everyone around me was successful and miserable.
Or dead.
Or dead, yeah. And I didn't see any joy anywhere in success. And when I met Mr. Verger, I saw joy and success in one human. And I said, I want to become that. I want to find out, how do I do that?
Yeah.
I don't want to be one of them.
Well, now, you were just talking about, you know, with all these musicians, what's the frame? How do I, you know, kind of package this in a way that the public will know who this artist is? How do you frame Emeril Lagasse or someone like that,
you know,
at a time when people aren't used to looking at chefs that way?
In some ways, it was simpler. In some ways. What I saw that I don't think most people saw was this amazing demand that had never been monetized. You could always buy a Super Bowl 50-yard line ticket. You could always get a ticket to a play if you had enough money. You couldn't get into, in those days, Le Cirque, or you couldn't get into Charlie Trotter's, or you couldn't get into Spago. I don't care how much money you had. I was getting calls from the barons of the world who could get anything. That equates to money, and that equates to celebrity and fame. And when I saw the way they were treated, they were making no money at all. It was sort of like the Afro-American artists in the Chitlin circuit. I had seen this before. I had been through it. I knew how to change it, and I just decided to do it. And it for me, that was almost the easiest chore I ever had.
When you saw Emeril Lagasse, did you say, that's a performer? That's someone who can do a live show?
It'd be nice for me to say that, but probably not the truth. Emeril was the only one of all the guys who went to video lessons to learn how to be Emeril in front of a camera.
Okay.
Nobody else was willing to do that. Everyone else said, no, we're just cooks. We'll do what we're doing.
Yeah.
Emeril was willing to do it.
Well, in talking about the musicians and now the cooks, we've sort of skipped over another major part of your career, which is the film industry, you know, Michael Douglas and Sylvester Stallone, and of course, Mike Myers and many, many others. And in this clip from the movie, Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, we hear from Sylvester Stallone, one of the celebrities talking about my guest, Shep Gordon.
It was really early in my career, and I read a book called Billion Dollar Babies. And there's a character in there, Shep Gordon, who's managing this maelstrom of maniacs. And I wanted to actually do the rock version of Citizen Kane with Shep being Citizen Kane, okay? So it'd be like Citizen Insane. I probably wasn't right for the role because Shep is much more endearing than I am, much more feral.
It's actually an interesting idea.
It was amazing. It was. I was sitting in my office, and my secretary said, Sylvester Stallone's on the phone for you. And I said, come on, you got to be kidding me. He said, no, he's on. I said, come on, I'm this little Jewish guy from Long Island, Sylvester Stallone, that's Rocky. He can't be on the phone. And I pick up the phone, and he asked me if I'd go to lunch. Are you kidding? I'd do anything. And when I got to lunch, he told me he'd bought the book, and he was going to play me, which I thought was just overwhelming. Obviously, after meeting me, he didn't do the movie. But I never got a chance to say thank you for doing this than thank you, Sly. He's a great man. He's so different than what so much of the public thinks of him.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me almost the first thing we hear you say, Shep, in this movie, is that when you sign someone, you look them in the eye, you take off your glasses, you look them in the eye, and you say, if I do my job right, I'm going to kill you. And you've obviously done something right with all these people that you've managed. Where did that kind of statement grow out? Was that the cautionary experience that you'd had early on of what fame does to people?
A sadly reality. I even feel it myself, and I'm not famous now, but just this little touch of doing the documentary brings out so many ill feelings and ill thoughts from people that I even can feel a little bit of it. And I don't even, this is not even scratching the surface, but I think fame is very difficult. It's very difficult to live with because it changes your life. It becomes very difficult to understand why am I famous. I do the same things that everybody else does. So self-worth issues become like under a magnifying glass every second. It looks from the outside like having millions of people adore you is easy, but it's really tough on the middle. Nobody knows why. There's no real answer to why, you know, why 100 people running down the street with a camera at me.
So how difficult was it for Mike Myers to get you to agree to this documentary?
In the end, it wasn't difficult. He asked me about 5 years, and I chose not to do it. And then I had some surgery, and he got me when I was very medicated in the hospital. And I said, yes, I'm sure it was an ego moment.
Uh-huh.
I do keep my word, so off the journey went. But it's his movie, and what a beautiful job he did. I mean, I still cry a little bit when I see it, which is amazing because it's my life.
Well, the film is called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. It is Mike Myers' directorial debut, and it does indeed star the longtime manager and entertainment industry insider, Shep Gordon, who's been with us here on Soundcheck today. Shep, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thanks. This is Soundcheck. Bit of the song Only You, a 1978 hit by the late Teddy Pendergrass, just one of the many musicians that Shep Gordon made famous. The film Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, opens in theaters tomorrow. Coming up, the guitarist and singer Warren Haynes has played with some of the biggest names in rock history, but today he'll join us solo for a live performance. And later I'll talk to the maker of a new documentary about B.B. King. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Warren Haynes is associated with three of the most musically colorful and revered road acts in rock history. He's been a pillar of the Allman Brothers Band for 25 years. He's frequently shared a stage with Phil Lesh and various other members of the Grateful Dead. And Haynes' own band, Government Mule, is famous for its hard-charging extended jams. But today, Warren Haynes joins me here in the Soundcheck studio all by his lonesome with some songs from the new Government Mule album called Shout. Here's a performance of a song called Captured from Warren Haynes live on Soundcheck.
Never wanted to be swept away. I thought I might lose myself. Nobody told me there'd be music, sweet music. See a smile.
That is Warren Haynes live solo here in the Soundcheck studio in a song called Captured. You'll find it on the new album by Warren's band Government Mule. The album is called Shout, and it's a pretty interesting record because you get a whole album of Warren singing and playing the guitar with the rest of the band. Then you get another album with the same group of songs, all being sung by various guest artists. For example, Jim James of the band My Morning Jacket does an alternate version of that song, Captured. But that's Warren Haynes, and welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this album sort of is part of a whole 20th anniversary for the band Government Mule.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that we've been together for 20 years, but we have, and so this record is kind of a nice way of acknowledging that, but also kind of acknowledging all the influences that have made up Government Mule. Because we started as a very experimental, improvisational power trio with myself and Alan Woody and Matt Apps. And we were basing the beginning of the band on bands like the Jimi Hendrix Experience, mm-hmm. and Cream. And
what about Pink Floyd?
We all love Pink Floyd.
Because that's, I mean, I didn't notice it on the record, but hearing just you, just the guitar here, I was thinking, wow, there's a guy who's listened to Dave Gilmour.
Absolutely. And I love Pink Floyd for a multitude of reasons. I love Gilmour's guitar playing and his voice. I love Roger's lyrics.
Roger Waters,
The whole concept, you know, what they did is so miraculous that they created something that was uniquely theirs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that went on a lot in the late 60s and early 70s and hasn't happened a lot since then, where a rock band would come up with a way of writing and performing and nobody else would tamper with it. They would go, well, that's theirs.
That's their thing, yeah.
Basically, when we recorded the studio version, it was about midnight. We had just learned the song, and we were virtually kind of playing it for the first time. We were still learning it. And that version had some charm about it that seems to get lost when you know the song very well. Mm. And so we went back to that version and said, yeah, there's something about this version that has kind of almost mistakes, you know what I mean?
The sense that you're discovering the song at the same time that we are.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Warren Haynes, who's singing and playing his electric guitar. So that must be similar to how you wrote the song, right? Just you and the guitar. You don't write in the studio with the rest of the band around.
Most of the mid-tempo stuff and the down-tempo stuff starts with me and an acoustic guitar.
So I mentioned that the album, Shout, is two records in one. You're singing on all of the songs in disc one.
Yes.
Disc two, Jim James sings that song, Captured. You've got Elvis Costello. You've got Dr. John. You've got, you know, Steve Winwood, a whole host of names, many of them going back to that kind of golden era of classic rock that you were talking about. How did that happen?
It happened midway in the recording process. It started with Funny Little Tragedy that I wrote that I felt like reminded me of a Elvis Costello song, much more so than anything I'd ever written and much more so than anything Government Mule had ever done. So I sent him an email and said, hey, I got this song. It's very different from us, and I want to get like an era-specific vocal sound. Any suggestions? And he wrote me this beautiful letter back saying, well, on this record I use this, and on that record I use that, but long story short, if you want that sound, you got to use a really cheap microphone.
Oh, man. That is often the key, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It turns out that's the secret on a lot of great records.
And he said, you know, on the early stuff, the budgets were so low that, A, we couldn't afford a decent studio, and the places we were recording had all cheap mics.
Yep.
So I did it, and I called him back, and I said, man, it worked great. And from that point forward, I started thinking it would be nice to hear him sing it. But we hadn't kind of gone there yet.
Yeah.
So the next song was Stoop So Low. It reminded me of Dr. John, and we were about to be on tour with Dr. John. So I thought, well, maybe I'll ask him if he wants to sing a verse or something. But we still hadn't gone there. And then we had written, Danny and I wrote this other song called Scared to Live, somehow turned into a reggae song.
Yeah.
And then we decided, oh, wow, it reminds us of Toots and the Maytals. So at that point, Elvis Costello and Dr. John and Toots became the first three.
And then you figured, why not just do the whole record again?
Exactly. So I sat at like 3 a.m. and looked at all the titles and said, who other than myself would I love to hear sing these songs? And just made a wish list and started making phone calls. And fortunately, it's all people that either I'm friends with or have some sort of working relationship with.
So I mentioned 25 years with the Allman Brothers. Now, you know, you and Derek Trucks had previously announced this was your last year with the band anyway.
Yes.
And now the announcement has come that, A, the canceled March concerts are happening at the Beacon Theater in New York in October, and B, that this is it. The Allman Brothers Band is ending. For you, that's been a 25-year journey. Was it supposed to be a 25-year journey?
Well, for me, it started as a reunion tour in 1989. They were doing a tour to honor their 20th anniversary, and they had just put out this retrospective box set called Dreams, and I had been playing in Dickie Betts' band, and they decided to reform the Allman Brothers to do one tour, and it was very successful, and the band surprisingly got along very well, and the music was great, so we just kind of kept doing it. We did a second year, we did a third year, and then it just turned into 25 years. But we all made the decision over the past two or three years that the 45th anniversary would be the right time.
Allman Brothers Band, final run of shows at the Beacon Theater will be in October. Those are rescheduled for March. In the meantime, Government Mule, with its own anniversary tour, 20th anniversary.
20th, yeah.
So that'll bring you guys to Mountain Jam,
which is the 10th
event.
Anniversary.
All right.
Of Mountain Jam. There are a lot of anniversaries this
Who
year.
Who keeps your calendar?
I definitely need a lot of help in that department. And our management has their hands full, but thankfully, everybody we work with, you know, there's a big cooperative, and we all try to make each other's life better. Not that it always works out that way, but whenever possible, it's nice to do that.
Government Mule is kicking off their 20-year-strong tour at Hunter Mountain Jam on June 7th, this Saturday. The Allman Brothers Band, Warren's other group, will be at Mountain Jam on Sunday, June 8th. So a busy weekend for Warren with both groups. Warren is here solo in the Soundcheck studio. He's going to do another song for us. This one is called Forsaken Savior, live on Soundcheck.
How does it feel to wake up in all your glory? Maybe you can recall that feeling now. Block out the memories of what happened overnight and pretend people aren't riding in the streets and pretend they don't instill you with fear. Forsaken Savior, where do we go from here? Do you have your sights set on another journey? Is it finally time to throw in the towel? Are you scared the world will never sing your praises? Do you bury your head in the sand? Do you step up and take it like a man? Forsaken Savior, it's all in your hands. And if you find your way back to reality, I think you'll find it really hasn't changed that. Maybe you're out of touch. Isn't the whole story that you don't stop? Never stop believing in the message. We'd all be a king if it were easy, but so few can take the pressure of the truth. So few can just refuse to fade away. Maybe it's time to pray.
That is called Forsaken Savior. It's music from Warren Haynes, live performance, solo, Warren singing and playing the guitar here in the Soundcheck studio. The full band, Government Mule, plays that song on the new record Shout, And Dave Matthews does the alternate take of that song on disc two of the new Government Mule record. Once again, Warren and the rest of the Allman Brothers Band have finally announced the end of the Allman Brothers Band in this, their 45th anniversary season, and the previously postponed shows at the Beacon from March have been moved to October. And Warren, it's been a lot of fun having you here playing solo for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Less than 48 hours away from our big night at BAM. It's Radio Love Fest, and you should join us, soundcheck, this Saturday at BAM's Harvey Theater. Hamilton Lighthouser will play some of his brand new album. We'll have a stand-up set from former Daily Show correspondent Wyatt Cenac, and more great music from the indie band San Fermin. Just a few tickets left. Get yours now by visiting bam.org/radiolovefest. In a moment, I'll talk to the director of a new documentary about the blues guitarist Riley B. King. Name doesn't ring a bell? Well, you may know him as BB. That's next on Soundcheck.
Got a sweet little angel. I love the way she spreads her wings.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. B.B. King changed the sound of the blues and rock music, but despite being so influential, no one really sounds quite like him. In a new documentary, dozens of musicians from several generations reflect on how this blues legend influenced them, and they all agree you only have to hear one note and you know it's B.B. King. The documentary is called The Life of Riley, and it traces B.B. King's rise from the orphan Riley B. King in the Mississippi cotton fields to the King of the Blues. The director of the film is John Brewer, and he joins me now from the Cotswolds in England. And John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thank you, John.
John, if you don't mind, I'd like to start off by playing a clip from the film. In it, we hear people like Eric Clapton and Buddy Guy and Derek Trucks talking about B.B. King's sound.
The character of any great musician is usually identifiable by the individuality of their vibrato. Most players are recognizable by that particular facet of their playing, and that's how I would know BB's playing and hit one. I can tell BB from one note. You know, most of us can, I think.
I'd say that's true, yeah. His sound is completely unique to him.
One note, you know, is all it takes.
The note with the vibrato.
One note.
One note.
And one note.
That's a clip from the new film Life of Riley about B.B. King. John Brewer, who directed the film, is talking with us today. John, where did B.B. King get this technique from?
It's a technique that he picked up in Memphis many years ago. And he basically bends his string in a certain way and repeats it. And that's the BB mark. And he's, of course, got it in his mind. I mean, it's a natural thing.
Well, there's a moment in the film, Life of Riley, where BB King talks about how he got that unmistakable sound. Let's listen.
And he used to play with a slide on his finger. And I could never get that. Well, I've got stupid fingers. They just wouldn't work. So in order to get somewhat the type sound that he had, I would trill my hand like that. And I think over the years I've done pretty good with it. Still don't have it right.
Still don't have it right. That's B.B. King talking about how he learned. He was basically trying to play like Booker White.
And well, Booker was his cousin, of course.
Right.
When he went to Memphis, you know, when he ran away from Damage the Tractor, he ran to Memphis. And Booker White took him in, and basically he realized how bad he was amongst these other musicians. And then he went back to Memphis years later, and he'd improved his style. But that was what he got from Booker White.
Well, we're speaking with John Brewer, the director of this B.B. King documentary called The Life of Riley. I did not know that Riley was, in fact, B.B. King's real first name. Of course, I didn't know that his career got its start when he damaged a tractor and ran away from the farm to go to Memphis. When he came back, he had developed, he had improved, he had gotten that unmistakable sound. And one of the songs in your film and also on the two-disc soundtrack is this classic from B.B. King's 1965 album, Live at the Regal. B.B. King singing, playing the guitar, of course. Every Day I Have the Blues is from his classic 1965 album, Live at the Regal. John Brewer, the director of the B.B. King documentary called The Life of Riley. It's out now on video on demand and available on DVD and Blu-ray and digital platforms as of June 17th. There's a two-disc soundtrack out now as well. John, it's a star-studded cast of interviewees in this documentary, including Bono from the Irish band U2, who collaborates with B.B. King at one point during their career, and that leads to one of the film's funnier moments, where you have Bono sort of recounting B.B. King saying to him, "Gentlemen, I don't do chords. I just don't do chords," which for a blues guitarist is kind of an unusual thing to say. And then at one other point, B.B. King talks about playing acoustic guitar and how he's decided he's never going to play an acoustic guitar again. So he is a bluesman, but he's a very distinctive kind of blues guitarist, isn't he?
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't know he didn't play chords. And that was one of the first things he told me. And then I started watching and I realized he didn't play chords. And I talked to a lot of musicians about that, and they didn't know he didn't play chords. So, and he doesn't play chords. But he does have this peculiar way of, he also can't sing and play at the same time. So, which I can sort of understand.
Yeah.
Because he's picking and he's basically concentrating on what he's playing. And He swings his guitar down to, you know, it was, if you watch footage of when he's standing, he's now sits, of course, to play. But if you watch him standing, it always goes, swings it down like he's finished doing that and he's on to the next thing and he'll grab the mic. Well, he does that now to a certain extent when he's sitting down. But he really doesn't play chords, and it's as simple as that.
It's kind of call and response between the singing and these kind of stinging guitar leads that he's made his career on. We're talking about B.B. King with John Brewer, the director of the B.B. King documentary, The Life of Riley. B.B. King's first big hit, 1952's 3 O'Clock Blues, shows us B.B. King still in the process of defining the B.B. King sound.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning, satisfied.
B.B. King from 1952, his first big hit was that song, 3 o'clock Blues. And you hear that in the documentary film as well. The film is called The Life of Riley. It is out now on video on demand and available on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital platforms on June 17th. There's a two-disc soundtrack out now as well. John Brewer, the director of the documentary, with me on soundcheck. And your film, John, reminds us that, you know, the blues was extremely segregated before the British invasion reintroduced it to wider, whiter America. How was B.B. King sort of involved in that transition?
He was responsible for playing to a white audience for the promoter, or Bill Graham.
Right.
And Butterfield had pushed Bill Graham to book B.B.
That's Paul Butterfield.
Paul Butterfield. And Butterfield had said, look, you ain't got anyone till you get B.B. And what had happened was he turned up for the gig, and there were loads of what we would refer, I think I was one actually, was a long-haired hippie. And they were sitting on the steps in San Francisco, and B.B. turned up and suddenly realized that he was at the wrong gig and called Graham and said, look, you know, I'm outside. I don't think I'm in the right place. He said, yes, you are. I'm coming down now. And he came down onto the bus and he said, listen, this is your audience. Don't panic. And that was the famous night that Bill Graham walked out on stage. He would always introduce the acts.
And he said, ladies and gentlemen, now would you believe that when he said that, you would hear a pin drop? He said, I bring you the chairman of the board, B.B. King. I've never been introduced like that before or since. When he mentioned my name, they all stood up. And for about 3 or 4 tunes after that, they would stand up after every tune. And I was so touched till I cried standing up there.
This was at the Fillmore, right, in San Francisco? It's a great moment in B.B. King's life in the film. John Brewer, the director of the B.B. King documentary called The Life of Riley. It did strike me, John, that, you know, for a guy who came through such hardships in the Deep South and, you know, pulled himself up and became the king of the blues, that we don't get a lot of, you know, we don't get to hear him waxing eloquent about the difficulties of being a black musician in the Jim Crow South.
He tries not to harp upon the fact, hey, you know, I'm a persecuted musician and I've had it rough all of my life, because he hasn't. I mean, you know, his room is at 80 degrees at all time. He has the most beautiful suite wherever he goes. He's got everything that he needs in life. That I know of as material things. But, you know, he's had a long and hard life. And I think he appreciates people that come to see him. He doesn't think that people want to hear about all the bad things of life. They should be hearing good things of life.
The film is called The Life of Riley, a documentary about Riley B. King, who we all know as B.B. King, the King of the Blues. It's out now on video on demand. John Brewer is the director and has been with us on Soundcheck today. John, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sometimes I get impatient, but she could without words, and she comes so sweet and softly, my hummingbird. And have you heard that I thought my life had ended, but I find that it's just begun, 'cause she gets me where I live. I'll give all I have to give. I'm talking about that hummingbird. Oh,
Oh, she's a little and she loves me too much for words to say. When I...
Tomorrow on the show, Americans love their cars. And they're pretty fond of musical theater, too. Did you know that for several decades, there were musicals about cars? Lots of them. I'll talk to someone who has spent probably far too many years digging up old recordings of these interesting shows. We'll play some of them for you. Plus, Dom Flemons, formerly of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, returns to our studio to talk about one of his musical heroes, the jug band leader named Gus Cannon. And Dom will play a bit of banjo for us, too. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.